In the first hour today, we'll be talking a bit about what the economic prosperity that we saw here in the United States in the late 90s, what that meant for America's working poor. Our guest is Catherine Newman. She is an anthropologist by her training. She's professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton. She has also taught at Harvard and at Columbia University in New York and has made something of a specialty of studying urban poverty and economic dislocation in the United States. She is the author of a number of books, just to mention a few: Declining Fortunes, The Withering of the American Dream, Falling from Grace, Downward Mobility in the Age of Affluence, A Different Shade of Gray, Midlife and Beyond in the Inner City. She's also written a couple of books based on a study that she began back in the early 1990s when she was studying African Americans and Latinos who worked in minimum wage jobs in Harlem. She and her colleagues have now followed some of these people from that time through the boom years of the Clinton era, and in fact, even into the early years of the 2000s. And she reports what she found in a recently published book. The book is titled Chutes and Ladders, Navigating the Low-Wage Labor Market. It's published by the Harvard University Press and the Russell Sage Foundation. That book came out last fall. And she's going to talk with us about the book here this morning. She reports, in fact, here maybe more good news than might be expected, as some people, as the title might suggest, managed to climb the ladder and were doing better in the 2000 than they had been in 1993. Although, of course, there are other people who weren't successful. And again, to look at the image in the title, they went down the chute. So more as we talk with her in this first part of Focus 580. Questions are certainly welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, people are welcome to join us with questions. We just ask people to be brief, so we can keep things moving along. Professor Newman, hello.
Hi there.
Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I guess I should say again, because we did talk, it's probably been a while, but I think the couple of the earlier books we actually discussed here.
I think that's right. And so I'm glad to be back with you.
And maybe I should mention, too, there will be another book, a newer one, in a sense, in the same sort of project that will be coming out sometime this year.
You mean The Missing Class?
The Missing Class.
That'll be coming out in September of this year, yeah.
Okay. Well, just to establish some context here, maybe you could talk a little bit about how it is that you got started in what turned out to be maybe a longer, more longitudinal kind of study than maybe you had in mind, and that starts out with the book that came out in 1999, I think, No Shame in My Game, which was a book that was written about some of the people that you met back in the early 90s when you started talking to people who were working. I think a lot of them were working in fast food establishments.
They were all working in the fast food world. Yes, I began that project in the early 90s because I wanted to change the national conversation about poverty away from what was then a sole reliance on studies of the population on welfare toward the much larger and, I thought, more important population of Americans who were low-wage workers. At the time I began that work, the focus was almost entirely on the dynamics of the welfare system. And it seemed to me that we had overlooked this very important group of people who were working but not earning enough money to pull above the poverty line. And there had been really no attention paid to these people, even though most poor people do work for a living. So I started my exploration of the world of the working poor in central Harlem in the early 1990s. And found that a lot of my own preconceptions were completely wrong. For example, I went out to look for teenagers working in the fast food industry, and what I found was that in central Harlem, which was a pretty poor area of the city at the time, very few of the people who held down these minimum wage jobs were teenagers. Most of them were working adults trying to support families on what were minimum wage and fairly stigmatized jobs. And that's because the labor market was so bad that teenagers couldn't compete for those jobs. So out in the suburbs, where that kind of job would typically have been held by a high school student earning, you know, extra sneaker money, in the city where unemployment was so high, those jobs were being held by adults trying to raise families on the minimum wage. And so that was my first shock. And after that, I became interested in what kinds of skills people acquire in jobs which we popularly think of as having no skill. And certainly no prestige, that much everyone would agree on, including the people holding those jobs. So I began being interested in what they learned on the job, on whether or not it was really possible to platform from a job like that to a better job, that is to move through the low-wage labor market out into a more working-class or middle-class kind of occupation. At the time that I did that study, the answer to those questions were no, no, and no. It was not possible to move out of those jobs. I watched a lot of people try. They went downtown to sit for civil service exams. They went searching for better jobs, often in groups looking for work that would pay them more. And routinely, they found the door really was blocked. And that was partly because unemployment was pretty high at the time. And there were ever more qualified people that were clogging up the mobility ladder, if you will. And that's where I left things when I started writing No Shame in My Game. But then when welfare reform became the law of the land, the question of what would happen to the working poor, to people who were out there in the labor market, when millions of welfare recipients were pushed off the rolls and into the very same low-wage and low-skilled labor market came into view. And I decided at that point to go back and find these people and to follow them up, and I followed them for a period of about 8 years. And the findings, which are reported in Chutes and Ladders, really surprised me, because all of the projections at the time were that this was going to be a catastrophe, that we would have millions of people who had exchanged welfare stipends for welfare-level wages, and that they would go nowhere. And as you noted in your introduction, that's not exactly what I found.
I'm really interested in this idea that around this time that we were talking about welfare reform, it seemed like the pressure was to get people off welfare, to get people working, to at least get them above the official poverty line. And then that seemed to be where we stopped. At that point, we said if we could get people to that point, then they would be on their own, and we'd say good luck and happy landings.
Mm-hmm.
And that there, as you say, I think that the issue of working poor, of whether you can live on a minimum wage job, at that time wasn't getting much attention. It's gotten some more because of writing that you have done, and people like Barbara Ehrenreich, for example, her books have gotten a lot of attention, focusing on this question of how difficult it is, maybe almost impossible, to actually support a family if you're making minimum wage, and other academics have written on that too.
Right.
So it has gotten some attention, but I'm still not. I'm wondering if even at this point, people really, there's a good enough popular understanding about how difficult it can be to be in this segment. That is, people who are working, who want to work, who want to be successful. If the opportunity comes by that they can grab on, they will. But at the same time, here these are people that are above the poverty line, but they're struggling.
Well, yes, it is very difficult. I mean, no one would say this was an easy life, but the question behind Chutes and Ladders was whether if people entered the labor market at the bottom, they had any hope at all of moving off the bottom into something better. I mean, after all, most of us, if we think about the jobs that we got when we first began working, I mean, if we're fortunate in life, very few of us stay in the kinds of jobs that were our first introduction to the labor market. I mean, I had all kinds of cruddy jobs when I was a teenager. That was not a horrible state of affairs as long as I didn't get stuck in it, which fortunately I didn't. But that is the big question. Can you move, what makes it possible for people to move off the bottom? Now, what I discovered in Chutes and Ladders is that a remarkable proportion of these minority workers who were largely low-skilled, who were starting off in a very poor neighborhood from very poor households, a remarkable proportion of them actually did do quite well. Not everyone, by any means, as you pointed out in your introduction. In fact, a substantial number of people didn't do well. But the projections at the time, and certainly the beliefs of most journalists and academics, was that this whole population was condemned to a lifetime of poverty. It might be working poverty, but it was going to be poverty, period. And that's just not what happened. Now, why is that? Well, part of the answer lies in what happened to the labor market during the late 1990s and the early part of this decade. It was probably the best labor market. It may be the best we're going to see in our lifetimes. We had extremely low unemployment. We had very low inflation. We had very high growth rates. I mean, we had conditions that economists essentially thought were impossible, to have such high growth and such low inflation. And what this led to was business expansion and actual labor shortages in many parts of the country. This then caused employers to begin looking harder at workers they might have previously ignored in their search for people to fill more skilled jobs. These conditions advantaged even those who were starting out in the kinds of neighborhoods where I found them in Harlem. And so we saw people who were able to move up inside the firms they worked for, even the fast food industry, as it began to expand and looked for more managerial workers, found people who were better able to go back to school and get more education because other people in their families were getting better jobs and could help support them while they got more schooling that qualified them for better work. I found people who were able to latch a hold of unionized jobs or jobs in sectors that are highly unionized and have to compete with union labor, so they offer better wages. All of it was booming, and it helped this population, not everybody, but it helped a substantial number of people. The people it didn't help were the people who, in a way, we always need to be concerned about, which was primarily women with young children whose child care responsibilities and lack of adequate child care, lack of adequate and steady child care, make it much harder for them to stay on the job no matter how much they want to. And so their patterns of employment are more episodic, even though they are quite firmly attached to the labor market. They face demands for family time that are difficult to manage on their own. And so they tend to be the ones who don't make this ascent for all kinds of reasons, which actually we could do a lot more about than we do.
Our guest, let me introduce again. Our guest is Catherine Newman. She is professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton. She's written many prize-winning books on work and class in America. One that we're talking about here this morning that was published last fall, I think, was Chutes and Ladders, Navigating the Low-Wage Labor Market. And that indeed came out at the end of last October. And she has written a number of books dealing with some of the same sorts of themes, including one that will be published sometime later this year. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It makes me think about some of the arguments that people make about the fact that if you can improve the economy, this is the old rising tide lifting all the boats kind of argument, that if you can generally improve the economy, that will benefit everyone. Now, in this particular case, I guess it wasn't all the boats, but you would have to say that one of the things that was, as you said, one of the things that was going on in this period was, yes, the rising tide was at least lifting some of the boats, and maybe if the economy hadn't been doing as well as it was, for those people who actually did pretty good, and we can talk about what exactly that means, that if the economy hadn't been doing what it was doing, then those people would not have seen that rise in their standard of living.
Well, it certainly would have been harder, but I don't want to suggest that it's impossible even in a weaker economy, because part of the analysis in this book looks at the same questions nationwide, that is, I move out of Harlem into large-scale national statistics to ask the very question, you know, was this a really unusual period, or are these unusual people? Is this something that does happen elsewhere in the country? And we have some big national surveys to help answer that question. And what they showed was that the difference between a weak economy and a strong economy is not quite as substantial as I expected. It's there. It's definitely there. But the gap isn't quite as huge as I thought it would be. People move up even in weak economies. Fewer of them and not as quickly, but they do. And the conditions under which they do depend a great deal on the particular industry they're in or their family configuration, whether or not they've been able to go back to school, and on social policies, which the rest of us are responsible for, like whether or not we open the gates to higher education through tuition subsidies and federal student aid, or shut them down, which makes it much harder for people to acquire the credentials they need to actually make a move up in the labor force. So there are lots of conditions that will make a difference in the lives of particular people, and the economy itself certainly has a big impact on the rate at which this kind of upward mobility happens. But it happens all the time. Even in weak economies, it happens.
Well, you just, for a second here, I want to put some numbers on the kinds of incomes that people had, just so the people who are listening can understand what it is we're talking about. You started out, you got to know some of these people and started to follow them when they were working minimum wage jobs.
That's right.
And by the time we get into 2001, 2002, some of them had seen astonishing, some of them had seen astonishing kind of increases in their standard of living. Not everyone did that well, but what kind of money are we talking about these?
By well, the most affluent of them all, yeah, the truly astonishing cases, were earning $60,000-$70,000 a year 8 years later. Now, these are people who, for example, men who found jobs driving FedEx trucks or the equivalent kind of just-in-time delivery institutions. That is the kind of job which is certainly somewhat more skilled than where I found them, but not enormously so. I mean, it's advantaging someone who knows who can drive and who can find their way around, a city with a map. I don't mean to diminish their skill or anything, but it's not as though they moved from being a fast food worker to being a surgeon. But those are unionized jobs. They pay extremely well. They offer full benefits. Or one woman I'm thinking of, for example, who did manage to get more schooling because her employer paid for it, helped her go back to college, and she ended up being the manager of a call system, a calling company that was in the advertising industry. Again, she is a success story because she got more education, so where I found her didn't hamper her in the very long run because she was fortunate enough to find employment in a company that would invest in her human capital and give her the chance then to move up. Another young woman I'm thinking of who was a single mother at the time I met her, who had been on and off of welfare, but during a period in which the welfare regulations permitted her to go to college to earn her stipend, so to speak, she was very clever and wise in what she chose to study. She took very practical courses in accounting. She managed to get herself some work-study jobs that gave her some practical experience with accounting. And by the time I found her 8 years later, she was working in the accounting office of a very important and elegant foundation here in New York City and earning a very good salary, able to take care of her child. And then she even moved on from there into public service. So if you had told me, or her, at the time that I met her when she was 19 and had a baby to take care of who was out of wedlock and who was on welfare, that 8 years later she would be working for a state agency in a very responsible position, having worked her way through the foundation world before that, I mean, nobody would have believed that was possible. So there are some truly dramatic stories of upward mobility with quite high salaries, but I certainly wouldn't want to give your listeners the impression that this happened to everyone, because right, it didn't.
Right. We have a caller here to bring into conversation. Let's do that. Someone who is listening in Champaign this morning, and it's line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if your guests would care to address what I think was a sort of classic denunciation of capitalism, that for it to exist in a country, it has to have an underclass. You know, a very deprived class. And I think you can accept all of our guests' arguments and still maintain that what we have in the society is like an underclass that is, you know, purposely or at least heedlessly left, you know, in poor circumstances, without health care, without adequate education for their children. Would you like to talk about that at all?
Well, I think if we look around the world at other capitalist societies, we see some pretty significant policy choices that are made that mean that even workers who have the kinds of jobs that the people I studied had when they started out do not suffer from the sorts of conditions you're talking about. So I don't know that capitalism itself demands an underclass or a lumpen proletariat, as some scholars in the past might have used the term, because we can look at the same people, the same kinds of people, just across the northern border to Canada and see a completely different standard of living. So there are huge choices that are made, even in capitalist societies, about redistribution, about the provision of health care, about wage subsidies, that really do change the picture. So I don't think I would agree with the view that capitalism itself necessarily requires this, low-wage and highly disadvantaged population. But I would say that a country that practices meager support to those who are at the low-wage end will certainly see such a population develop. That being the case, though, the condition of the economy does make a difference in how persistent that fate is, how long it lasts in any given person's life.
I don't see that you're really counting the argument. Like, all of my life in this country, we've had an underclass. And I can see where you say, like, other countries manage to mitigate the, like, lifestyles that these people are subjected to. But all of my life in this country, we've had people, like, you know, in dire circumstances, and we seem to, like, be pretty blithe about it.
Well, you asked me whether or not this was endemic to capitalism. So I answered that there are lots of capitalist countries that don't have this persistent problem you're identifying. I don't disagree with you that that's how it has frequently worked out in the U.S. I'm just saying there are choices to be made, and we made one set of choices, and other countries like Sweden and Denmark and Canada, and the list is actually quite long,
right,
made a different set of choices.
Okay, so you would agree that in the United States we seem to have made the choice to allow this to happen. Is that right?
Well, even in the United States, there have been periods when we did better than we're doing now. I mean, I think the 1960s and the war on poverty, we made some significant strides, and you look at the numbers of, you know, the poverty numbers, and you can see some pretty profound changes that happened then. I think the last 20, 25 years have been particularly bad in the United States. So there, I think you have a very fair point.
Thank you.
All right. Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is Catherine Newman. She is professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton. She's also taught at Harvard and at Columbia University and has written a lot about poverty in America. The book we're talking about here this morning is Chutes and Ladders, Navigating the Low-Wage Labor Market. That was published last fall. She's also got one that will be coming out this year, The Missing Class, The Near-Poor Experience in Modern America. And as she explained at the beginning of the program, the people that are in this book we're talking about here this morning, Chutes and Ladders, are some of the people that she got to know back in the early 1990s when she was doing some research on people who are working in fast food restaurants in Harlem, earning minimum wage. And she wrote about them in the book No Shame in My Game, The Working Poor in the Inner City, a book that's still in print if you're interested in going back and taking a look at that book. And she explained that she was interested in trying to get back with some of these people and to see how now in the early parts of the 2000s, how they were doing, and found indeed some of them had done surprisingly well. Some of them have managed to come up some, but not as well as the people who were at the very top. And then some people had actually managed to slip down perhaps even further, or at least they had not managed to work their way above the place where they were back in the early 90s when she first got to know them. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just for a second to stay with the idea that, as you explained, that when you got back and were looking at some of these people and how they were doing now, you found that, as you said, some people had seen these astounding increases in their standard of living. There was another group that was sort of in the middle where they had seen improvement, but not as significant as the people on the top. And then there were these people that were really at the bottom, who were not doing well at all. And you talked a little bit about how it was that the people who were at the top managed to work up. Either they were already they had a job where there was an opportunity for moving up. They had the opportunity, either because of their employer or because of their family situation, to step out for a bit. of working and get more education. And then there were some people who managed to get a union job, which any of those three things really could be an opportunity for improvement. For those people, particularly those people who were at the bottom, what really was the problem? What was the difference between what exactly was the difference between some of the differences between the people who were at the top and the people who were at the bottom?
Well, I think the most systematic difference was the one I've already mentioned, which is that they had rather dramatically different family circumstances. Mm-hmm. Some of the people at the top also were single parents, but they were blessed with a network of family members who could help them regularize their child care. And then their children got older. And as their children got older, they became more autonomous. And if they didn't have more kids, which they didn't, they could stay in the labor market and sort of pile up the kind of track record that it takes to make the leap to better jobs in the future. But for those who were at the bottom, often the situation was that they had more unstable family lives. They didn't have anybody to help them. So if the child got sick, they had to leave the workplace to take care of them, and they were in workplaces which were not particularly forgiving and didn't offer the kinds of benefits that Princeton University does, for example, in the way of sick days or vacation days. They were working for employers who didn't provide any of those benefits, and they tended to then build up a track record of more unstable employment. But it's really important to note, most of them continued working. It's just that their track records weren't quite as stable. Now, there were also some who really were kind of like the welfare clients that I think welfare reform was aimed at. They were a tiny group, but they were there, of people who really weren't very interested in being in the labor market, didn't like the kinds of jobs that they could qualify for, and were really subsisting on the kindness of girlfriends or boyfriends or other family members, and their long-term fate was not very happy to contemplate. These were often people who also had histories of substance abuse or mental health problems. As many other studies of former welfare recipients have shown, the people who end up staying on the rolls often do have these problems of depression or substance abuse or mental illness. But there weren't very many people like that. There really weren't. But the ones at the bottom, generally speaking, lacked the sort of underpinnings of stable child care and also were not well educated. And for them, the options in the labor market were pretty bad.
So then just let me ask one follow-up, and then we have some more callers here. It sounds as if there would be some obvious or evident things that could be done to try to provide some kind of support for people like that that would make it more likely that they could have some of the kind of success that some of the other people had.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, I think a vastly improved and enriched child care system or early childhood education would be a huge shot in the arm for the kinds of people who I knew who were scraping along the bottom, because very often the alternatives they faced, which pulled them out of the labor market, were completely unsavory, and none of us would subject our children to those conditions, babysitters that were unreliable or much worse than unreliable, and that's all they could afford. Their first thought is for their children's well-being, and given the options they faced, they often, found that they just couldn't guarantee their children's safety, which was the first thing they had to worry about. Yeah, sure, there's plenty we could do about that. And in fact, that would be an investment in the well-being and future economic mobility of generations to come. In countries that invest heavily in early childhood education, the long-term prospects of those children in the labor market are far greater than what will be true for our kids if we leave them in crummy child care with unqualified people who are not prepared for school when they begin school and are way far behind their middle-class counterparts who are now in, early childhood education from the age of 3 or so onward.
Hmm. Well, we have some other callers here. Let's go ahead and bring them into that conversation. Next, we'll go to someone in Champaign. This is line number 2. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I want to present a brief scenario and then ask your guests a question. In the late 1960s, I worked with a large consulting company that had $1 million contract with the Department of Labor in New York to train and place low-skilled blacks, Hispanics, and whites, particularly from rural areas in the South, in the supermarket industry in the greater New York, New Jersey area. The program was a complete and total failure because there was very little, few, if any, of those who went through a two-week training program on working in a supermarket, and we created a an artificial supermarket environment, could last more than a week or 10 days. They could not deal with the pressure of working in an environment like that. If they were yelled at, they often ran out, throwing down their aprons and never coming back to collect their paycheck. It appeared that they were comfortable when they felt when they were in the training environment, which was a very safe and supportive one. But once we put them into the actual world, they couldn't cope. My question is, to what extent has this kind of fear of the workplace environment changed, or is it still a real factor that has to be accounted for?
I think your questions are very well put. Judging from the numbers, which are an absolute all-time record of the proportion even of women with children under the age of one who are in the labor force full-time, I would have to say that the sort of psychological conditions you're speaking of must have withered away quite a bit because those numbers are incredibly high now. But I would also say that the track record of job training programs is quite uneven. The best of them are the ones that are more durable than 2 weeks, are very tightly calibrated to the demands of employers. And we often, and I'm sure you would agree with this, we often find that when the government gets into the business of job training, it tries to do it on the cheap. And that's not to say that the expenditures are not enormous, because they are, but two-week training probably doesn't work for very many people in very many occupations. It takes longer than that. And when we do the high-quality version, which is more expensive, we tend to see better success rates. But I would agree with you that the track record on job training programs from the 1960s onward is not brilliant. And I think one of the reasons it's not brilliant is that it's very rarely done in the kind of fully invested, high-quality way that might well make a difference. So we don't have a lot of programs to look at that were of the high-end sort, because we are trying to serve a lot of people with as minimal a set of expenditures as possible. But there are job training programs that have much better track records than the one you're talking about for the present period. And so, it's hard to know. Are we just doing a better job at job training, or are people different? I wouldn't even begin to know how to answer that question.
Oh, thank you very much.
All right. Well, let's go to another caller, and that would be Urbana and line number one. Hello.
Good morning, Catherine Newman.
Good morning.
For us, would you be so kind as to distinguish between the terms exploitation and oppression? And why isn't the term used more in the mass media? And what is it of these two, the question on the table? Thank you for taking my call.
Well, I don't myself tend to deal in very loaded terms of this kind. I think their meaning is more political than social scientific, and everybody's entitled to their political opinion, of course. So I have no objection to you using the terms, or even me when I have a different hat on. I would say that the low-wage labor market is not one that most people find very pleasant or encouraging. It's oftentimes better than they thought it would be, and the employers turn out to be better than they thought they would be, but not always. There are certainly employers who take advantage of the desperation of workers who need to keep their jobs, especially immigrant workers who are undocumented. And I think most of us would characterize that as exploitative, and it certainly feels oppressive to those who have them. But it's also the case that, I met many employers in inner-city Harlem who could have easily located elsewhere in easier places to make a living, who were paying their workers when they got good grades, who were helping them get identification, who never had it before, or open bank accounts or guarantee leases with landlords, who are offering literacy programs. These things had nothing to do with the job. So these were efforts on their part to be humane employers. I wouldn't say that everybody does that, but I would say I was surprised to discover how many Harlem employers were doing so. And while the workers understood that their jobs were not high prestige, and in fact they shared this sense of stigma that the rest of us convey to them about the lowly quality of these jobs, and didn't see much dignity in them and didn't see much skill in them, where I saw a lot more skill myself than they did. So the feeling of being at the bottom of the totem pole is definitely one that they experienced. The only people who were worse off were those who had no jobs at all. Those were people who were really oppressed because they had nothing. And relative to those people, the workers I studied felt a sense of dignity that came, I argued, from their belonging in a great mainstream. The social scientists who were interested in poverty tended to write about a sort of oppositional and separated subculture, as if somehow people living in the communities like the ones I studied were a different kind of person than the rest of the American, the great American labor force. And what I found was exactly the opposite. Their aspirations were very similar, their language was very similar, and their sense of the hierarchy was very similar too, which meant they often looked upon themselves as not worthy because they shared this viewpoint that so many other Americans have, that if you're flipping burgers, you can't be a very worthwhile person. So they were often wounded by their acceptance of these very mainstream ideas. But they accepted them, in a sense, because they aren't really different. They don't really constitute a separated subculture.
We have about 12, 13 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I would like to introduce our guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last 5-10 minutes. Catherine Newman is professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton. She has also taught at Harvard and also at Columbia University in New York, and has written quite a bit about issues of poverty and economics in America. Among her books, one that we're talking about here this morning from last fall, Chutes and Ladders, Navigating the Low-Wage Labor Market, and also No Shame in My Game, The Working Poor in the Inner City. That book, which was published in 1999, the result of some work that she did back going back to the early 90s, looking at people who were working minimum wage jobs in fast food restaurants in Harlem. And what she decided to do was to try to follow those people along. And in Chutes and Ladders, what she does is she gets back again with some of these people to ask this question. And now, over that period of time, decade or so, how are people doing? And she found that, in fact, that for some reasons she has explained, some people are actually doing very well. They've seen significant increases in their standard of living, other people not. She also has a book that will be coming out this year, The Missing Class, The Near-Poor Experience in Modern America, and has a number of others. So she's done a lot of interesting work. You can head down to the library or the bookstore if you're interested in looking at some of her books. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll keep going here. We have some other folks. Next is line 3 in Champaign.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm very interested. I just read some startling statistics from the Children's Defense Fund of Marion Wright Edelman. And three statistics I want to cite to you quickly, because I do think it has a bearing on African Americans and their relegation in large numbers to the underclass and affected adversely by the inability to easily engage in upward mobility. One, 723 black babies are born into poverty each day in the United States of America. 284 black babies are born to teen mothers each day in the United States of America. And 1,222 black children are arrested each day in the United States of America. And while there has been an increase in the middle class of African Americans, there has been correspondingly, if I'm not mistaken, and I'm sure those stats probably bear something to do with this, a significant increase in the underclass. In light of that, in light of the capitalistic system we have, what hope is there for black people as a group, a majority group, to lift themselves out from the underclass?
Well, Well, I think that modern history has actually been fairly encouraging on this point. Not to discount any of the facts you pointed to in the beginning of your comments, poverty, African Americans are definitely overrepresented in the poverty population. There is no question about that. And out of wedlock and teen childbearing certainly makes a contribution, a very significant contribution, to those poverty rates. That said, the rates of teenage pregnancy have been falling. The poverty picture, while it's still quite serious, has not actually deepened very much. It's been actually fairly constant. The growth of the black middle class has been absolutely astounding. Absolutely astounding. I mean, so much so that to speak just in terms of race is actually not going to get us very far anymore. We really need to understand the intersection of race and socioeconomic status or class, because we have a burgeoning black middle class. We have extraordinary rates of home ownership, for example, among African Americans. That has just absolutely exploded in the last 10 years, and that reflects partly this mobility for African Americans. But within the black population, there are hugely different trajectories that depend on class origins, on educational attainment, on discrimination. And the internal divisions or separations are at least as profound as the ones that exist between racial groups. So I would have to say that, in a sense, both of your point about persistent black poverty is absolutely true, but so is the point about black mobility absolutely true, and that what we really have to understand is that there is a group that my former colleague William Julius Wilson called the truly disadvantaged that we really need to worry about, and recognize at the same time that there is a very significant, far more advantaged population of African Americans that we have never seen before. So I would say there's good news and there's bad news.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to line one. This is also someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Mm-hmm. Good.
You know, one of the best examples that I've ever seen occurred in Los Angeles in terms of opportunity after the in the 60s with all the riots and everything in Los Angeles. Lockheed Martin went and located their L-1011 plant there in South Los Angeles. And what they did was they went out there and they hired right off the street. Anybody that would walk through the door was given a job building L-1011s. And they followed those people, and nearly every one of those people that got a job, they became unbelievably successful. And the real antidote to poverty is big-time industrial activity. And this country really has an opportunity to do it again, and nobody on this campus is going to like the answer, and that's, you know, a huge synthetic fuels industry and something that pays $25 or $30 an hour, just like Lockheed Martin did.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I don't know how likely the particular industrial outcomes you have in mind really is. That's not really my area of specialty, but where I do completely agree with you is that we don't really need to worry very much about fixing people's culture. I think that's really where I sort of began my research. What really matters is an opportunity structure. If the opportunities are there, the response is almost overnight. When we saw unemployment fall down below 2% in Massachusetts, in what was called the Massachusetts Miracle, young African American men who were absolutely on the bottom of the preference queue for most employers flooded into the labor market and were hired in record numbers. They didn't change their culture overnight. What changed was the opportunity structure around them. Now, will that capture absolutely everybody? No, but you know what? We don't need to think about absolutely everybody. We need to think about starting massive trends toward higher wage employment. And people will follow. That is what the real bottom line lesson of Chutes and Ladders is. When opportunity opens, hardworking people and people looking for work, not just the people who had the jobs, people who were scouring the earth for jobs, will respond to those opportunities. And if they respond and they do well, they set an example for those coming behind them. It clears the floor for new entrants to the labor market. So whether we can do this through, you know, heavy industry, I don't know. I'm sort of agnostic on that point. Whether we need to focus on opening employment opportunity, there you have absolutely no, I have no argument with that. I think that's absolutely critical.
Well, we just looking at unemployment, for example, you have some figures here showing what has happened between 1990 and 2003, and that we saw a significant decline, say, from the late 90s to about 2000, and then it started to come up some more. Also, and over that same period of time, some of the people that you follow did see also a significant increase in their earnings. What has happened now, though, within the last 5 years or so? Has there been an accompanying downturn in how people are doing that goes?
Well, you know,
that,
I wish I could answer your question, but I think, you know, all good studies and have to come to an end at some point. And having followed people for 8 years, I didn't really have the resources to continue following them. It's actually very hard to do this kind of research, as you might imagine, especially in this age group, sort of mid-20s to mid-30s and beyond. People move around a lot. It's very hard to keep a hold of them, so to speak. So I don't have an answer to your question for the most recent period. Really, my knowledge of what happened to them ended in about 2002. You know, I'm satisfied that that is a approximate answer to your question, because that actually included the downturn that began after 9/11. So I was able to look at people who had kind of survived what then became a pretty sharp decline in the labor market here in New York after 9/11. And the question I had there was, had they become valuable enough to their employers that they could ride out the cuts that followed, you know, when New York entered a sort of recession at that point? And I think the answer was, for the people at the top, that was the case. They had, by that time, become sufficiently skilled and valuable that they didn't face the sort of last hired, first fired problem. But it's, you know, even very well-educated Americans who have very long track records in the labor market face a lot more employment instability than they used to. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where I began my social science career, studying the insecurity and instability in the American middle class. And I'm afraid that, you know, after about the mid-1970s and really gathering force in the early 80s, we just started to see a lot more insecurity reaching up higher into college-educated professional positions. So there are no guarantees, and certainly these people are not as advantaged as those I began studying that long ago. So I would never want to claim that, you know, once you make it up as high as they have, you are once and forever safe, because I don't know that anybody is, other than those of us fortunate enough to have tenured jobs. And there isn't any tenure for anybody else.
Let's talk with at least one more caller here, Champagne, and this is somebody. Well, I have somebody here on line number two, I think. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was on a cell phone.
Oh, go ahead.
Are you familiar with the book Banker to the Poor by Muhammad Yunus and his concept of microloans to the very poorest people to allow them to utilize the skills that they've gotten in their life to start businesses of their own? It was started in Bangladesh,
mm-hmm.
but now they have chapters in South America and the United States to help people pull themselves out of the poverty cycle.
Yeah, this is sort of based on the Grameen Bank idea, which has been very successful in extremely poor countries. It tends to be maximally successful when people live in tight-knit communities that exercise a lot of peer pressure to repay those loans. We don't see quite as much success in the U.S. context as we do in Bangladesh, interestingly enough. Well, here's my thought. I mean, I think all of these efforts are meaningful and important. When I look at the numbers for small business failures, it makes me a little nervous about relying on that as a solution. I mean, I think part of the picture certainly can lie in entrepreneurship, but it's tough. It's really tough, and the failure rates for small businesses are exceedingly high. And so I worry a little bit when people who have rather marginal savings dump them all into something that can leave them very vulnerable. But I would never say that we shouldn't make those loans available. I think we should, but I don't think we should rest on that as a solution to this problem.
Okay, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, thanks for the call. Just to finish up, I'm interested in the new book, The Missing Class. It sounds as if you're continuing to be interested, at least in this point, of focusing on those people who are above the poverty line.
That's right.
But who are maybe just a bit above, the people who are making it, but who are just barely making it.
Well, it turns out that there's actually twice as many Americans who are in what I'm calling the missing class, by which I mean people who are 100% to 200% of the poverty line. So they're all above the poverty line, and they would not be counted in any of the poverty statistics that we use. And in fact, they're not really tracked at all. We just hardly pay attention to these people. But there are 57 million Americans who fall into this category I call near poor. And I think that a lot of our attention and policy has been directed at people below the poverty line, and we just sort of ignore this group altogether. But they're huge, and they're important, and their experience is different from those who are in extreme poverty and who live in very, very poor neighborhoods. The near poor tend to live in neighborhoods that are gentrifying. It's not easy for them to stay in those neighborhoods, but they are definitely in places where the general patterns of safety and investment have increased. They often have other kinds of problems that have to do with debt, because their expectations for their standard of living rise faster than their income. They are where they are because they're working exceedingly hard. I mean, all the hours around the clock, and this is often very problematic for their children. So while the adults are definitely doing better and the households are doing better financially, you can see a certain cost being paid by unsupervised teenagers and by young children who are in school systems that are ever more looking to parents to help children get beyond the No Child Left Behind high-stakes test.
We're going to have to stop. Perhaps we can say when the book comes out, we can talk some more.
I would be delighted.
Well, I appreciate you giving us your time today.
Thank you so much.
Our guest, Catherine Newman, she's professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton. Her book, Chutes and Ladders, Navigating the Low-Wage Labor Market, is published by the Russell Sage Foundation and Harvard University Press.